Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Nucleus Investment Insights. The topic we're going to discuss today is the China property market and whether there's going to be a crash landing in 2022. On the agenda, we'll talk about why this market's boomed for the last 30 years. Then we'll look at the current state of the market and how the property development sector is now going bust. Next, we'll discuss the policies that have triggered this and the goals behind them. We'll also then investigate future potential moves by the Chinese government. Lastly, we'll have a look at the impacts on iron ore and metals. Then, as always, we'll discuss the investment implications. My name's Sam Kerr, and I'm the Senior Advisor at Nucleus Wealth. Today, we have David Llewellyn-Smith from Macro Business, and he's also the Chief Strategist at Nucleus Wealth. David, hi. How are you going today?
Good, thanks, Sam. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to hear. And as always, we've got the head of investments, Damien Klassen. Damien, I know you're on holiday at the moment, so thanks for taking the time to be here also.
Thanks, Sam. Good to see you.
You too. Just a quick reminder before we get started. If you enjoy our content, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and click the bell below to be informed when we go live or have a new episode recorded. Alternatively, follow us on your preferred podcast platform. Our show is available on all the majors. For those of you listening live today, feel free to drop your questions in the YouTube live stream chat, and we'll do our best to answer them during the show. So now we've got that little bit of housekeeping out of the way, we'll get into the episode. So, Damien, I'll hand it over to you to get us started.
Yeah, sure. Just a quick one from me. But, you know, I think some of the key things I just wanted to highlight is that, you know, we're moving into some quite uncertain times at the moment. There's a lot of different, put up a piece in the last few days talking about the sort of titanic forces that are affecting the markets from sort of both directions. And one of the key ones is really what's going on in China, the slowdown, the extent of the slowdown versus the assumption that the Chinese government's going to step in and start spending lots of money. And I guess it's still completely possible that they do, but, you know, there is a... I think there's some misconceptions, and certainly in terms of the market pricing, we're seeing seems to be pricing in that bailing out the property sector is a bit of a done deal, whereas it's still far from it. And so let's jump straight in, I guess, Dave, with some of these thoughts about the policy goal. I suppose that we've had a few things out from Xi in recent times talking about houses for living, not for speculation.
I mean, that's the refrain that we've had for several years now, and it was kind of boosted under the broader rubric of common prosperity last year, as this housing reform package developed. And of course, it's a broader reform package than just property, but property is very central to it. And so why do it then? Well, there's a number of different reasons. One key one is China has a very, very big demographic problem. Its birth rate is pretty much collapsing, and demographers are being forced to pull forward the year at which the Chinese population begins to shrink. It almost did it last year, but just eked out a small gain. But if they can't turn this around very quickly, then... You know, most forecasters have the population shrinking kind of sometime in the 2030s, but it would come at least a decade early. And that comes with all sorts of economic problems.
And the working age population is already shrinking.
It is, quite right. If you can't get some more young people out there, then you'll have fewer and fewer people supporting more and more retirees. And that's.
Yeah, and rapidly aging.
Yes, and that's not a recipe for economic success. So very expensive houses is playing a role in young people not reproducing, basically. So that's one of the key drivers. Then on top of that, there's the primary macroeconomic driver, which we've discussed many, many times, which is just through this early development phase of the Chinese economy. It has overbuilt considerably in real estate, certainly residential, probably commercial as well. And that's come, or over the long term, that comes with a huge kind of debt and leverage overhang that starts to weigh very heavily on the productivity of the economy and, you know, the marginal increase of growth or the marginal efficacy of debt in your economy. And so you need more and more debt for less and less growth. And this comes with the risk of, you know, combined with the demographic problems of China slumping into what is known as the middle income trap, which is not a great long-term proposition for a tyrannical centralized government that wants to keep its population's living standards rising. So that's the second major one. So these
Dave,
very...
just quickly, what's the middle income trap? Do you mind just explaining that?
Sure. I mean, it's effectively when a developing economy that has been relying heavily on very high marginal returns in investment projects because it's come out of, you know, cheap labor, cheap land, and all these other things that that drive
and often forced savings as well.
Yes, so forced savings, and it drives very, very swift growth with lots of fast income gains, etc. But at a certain point, some call the Lewis turning point, you reach a development threshold where you're no longer as competitive as you once were. All of those really easy, high-return projects are exhausted. You're now investing in very marginal projects instead, and your income growth, national income growth, and especially per capita income growth starts to stall unless you shift the nature of the economy to one that explicitly promotes income growth for consumption. So that's a very, very well understood and well-trodden path by all kind of developing economies over the last 50 years.
And only a couple of handful have managed to escape it. So yes, South Korea and Japan.
That's right. None of whom are big continental economies. So it is a challenge for China, but they're giving it a crack. So what they've done primarily to try and start to at least change this is they put this thing in called the three red lines policy for developers. And it basically they're just leverage ratios for their property, big problem, all property developers, to stop them overbuilding. You know, there's a raft of other policies in there that have effectively stalled house price gains in China for the last 5 years, at least in the major cities. There were still gains in the lower tier cities, you know, the kind of in the western frontiers and central China and stuff, which is important because that's where so much of this kind of wasteful overbuilding has been, and where you've really had an awful lot of investment dollars just flowing into empty apartments in the hope of capital gains over the long run. And so, you know, we have this phenomenon of ghost cities. So in effect, they've tried to contain the leverage of the property development sector. What this has resulted in, as we probably expected, is all sorts of stress for these developers because they are extremely leveraged entities, you know, far more leveraged than anything that would operate successfully in developed countries. And they operate really on Ponzi models, like we all know of Evergrande, of course. The rules that govern this sector in China are very peculiar from a developed economy standpoint, insofar as most consumers there pay for their apartment up front before it's built. And so the developers have these huge pools of capital before they actually need to deploy it into building. And that has led them to lead very extravagant lifestyles and to kind of invest these dollars that were supposedly in escrow into all sorts of crazy projects and to just overbuild like crazy. however, when you contain their leverage, then, you know, they've also used a lot of debt in these things, and suddenly it very quickly turns on its head, and you find that these businesses that had so much cash actually have none, and as they hit repayment schedules on a lot of their debts, they can't pay.
It's this idea of pro-cyclicality as well. As we've spoken about it in a few different areas, but basically the idea is if you've got lots of debt, and what David's saying is that it's not just normal debt. They've got sort of multiple layers of multiple flavors of debt that sort of all sort of add up to each other, and some of them that don't get considered as debt, but you know, effectively it is extra leverage. As long as prices are going up and you've got lots of debt, then you're actually doing really well. You're doing twice as well because you own this property and you've got this debt against it, and the property's gone up by 10%, and so and you've actually got only got 10% equity in the whole thing, and so you've just doubled your equity. But the problem is, as soon as it turns the opposite direction, then you get double the downside as well. You only need things to fall 10%, and you've wiped out your equity completely.
Exactly right. And so, you know, what's happened is focused in particular on US dollar debt in these developers, where a lot of the overbuilding was funded from offshore bonds that were issued by the developers in US dollars. And so in a sense, they're actually going around their domestic system to overbuild. Owing to, you know, I guess the political necessities, of the Chinese government, as this thing is starting to unravel, they've really allowed all of the US dollar denominated debt to foreign investors, to be defaulted upon while they're protecting the local investors, both in terms of the projects to be delivered, but also the bonds that were issued domestically. So domestic investors. So I've just got a chart here of the, US dollar high yield, that is junk bond index, which is comprised roughly of half Chinese. I think 50 or 60% of it is Chinese developers, and it's absolutely just been smashed. Nothing they've done to date has prevented it. I mean, yesterday we saw some more policy moves, and there's a big jump in this index yesterday and probably today, you know, a bit of a save and et cetera. But, you know, we don't think that's the bottom for this either. And in effect, what we're looking at here is a kind of is a credit crunch. So these developers can't get any more of this excess debt for excess projects, and so they can't roll over other bonds and other debts, and they're into, you know, a classic kind of debt deflation. So we can see that.
The other problem as well, given that financing structure we spoke about, was that they've also got to, if they want to start a new project now, they've also got to convince a whole bunch of people to prepay for them.
Yes,
because that's been their funding model. And if they can't convince people to prepay for them, they want to build them themselves, then they actually need heaps more debt than
they
because
do.
They're effectively getting free debt from the end purchase.
Exactly. And of course, as this has all played out, you know, dirty laundry hanging in public, there's you know, quite a lot of skepticism about buying property suddenly in China. And so this is our next chart, where demand has fallen away, kind of, you know, oscillating, but down 20 to 30% year on year. And it's been in that range really for the last 6 months or so. It's gotten a bit better in a few months and a bit worse here and there, but there's no real trend change at this point. And so it's down a lot. Sales are down a lot. And there's clearly, you know, some demand caution, as you would completely expect, given very high profile, indeed household name developers going bust, and concerns about project delivery. Now, the Chinese government has acted on this quite a bit, as I said, in terms of protecting those who have bought apartments and stuff. But, you know, it's still a big leap of faith to think that you can jump over that gulf and expect perhaps even just something as inconvenient as delays on delivery for what you've bought. And that's, you know, could be much worse than that. So obviously there's some caution in the market suddenly over this. The other reason for that, of course, is that the various measures to slow the market have resulted in falling prices. And so there's not a lot of incentive to jump into that either. This is particularly the case when we, look at, again, the sort of frontier markets where a lot of the building has been and where some of the price gains were over recent years, the higher price gains. And I've got a house prices chart here showing that really the upper tier cities in China haven't grown in 5 years in price, but hardly at all. In fact, they've been falling in real terms. But those frontier cities, the price gains were still there. But with this crisis now,
so this is the China new house prices. The chart on the right, yep. That's the one.
It is, yes, yep. Yes. And those lower tier cities, third and fourth, a little bit second, the prices are falling now much faster than they were than they are in top tiers. You know, year on year, they've only just started to fall. They've been falling month on month for, you know, 6 months or so. But, you know, these indices lag a fair bit. It's an official index. And, like, you can talk to people on the ground in the know who are already talking kind of prices down by a third in these lower tier cities. So, you know, the fact is, as these developers have been hit with cash crunches, you know, they've had to sell assets. So they've had to dump stock into the market, sell it cheaply. They need to scramble, as Damon says, to get more projects and more to get cash in the door. So they're discounting on new sales. So it's just this whole kind of, as Damo says, pro-cyclical unwind in the market now, as well as in the developer balance sheets. So I mean, that's ongoing there. You know, we'll come to some of the policy fixes that have made a little bit of a difference so far, but there's still plenty of downside momentum on that.
So, Dave, just quickly, we've got a viewer question here. So how much additional damage would tightening in the US or Western central banks cause China? And does it increase the pressure for the CCP to relax the three red lines?
The first one is potentially a lot. If the Fed actually it does follow through and is forced to, or either is forced to or does hike, the more it hikes, the more you would expect to see a rising US dollar. And China is obviously already cutting rates to fight this. And so basically the credit spread, or, you know, the yield you can get on US bonds versus the yield you can get in China is falling away really fast. And so that's pressure on the yuan. That's where the rubber could hit the road for China. If that process really accelerated and the yuan started to fall a lot, then that has all sorts of slightly scary knock-on effects, both for China and emerging markets generally. And that's the kind of thing that we got into in 2015 when we had a kind of global commodity rout on the back of a falling yuan. The Fed could play quite a big role in this, and that is one of the triggers I'll get to later on that could force a reversal of the three red lines if that process went far enough. So that is a line of reasoning that is well worth retaining and thinking through as this develops. Just completing state of the market, the big one here for sort of real market impacts is actually new property starts, and they've been absolutely hammered in the last quarter of last year. They're down 28%, a little bit more, over 3 months, and it's basically the fastest, worst quarterly fall year on year on record. Land sales have been smashed even more. They're down like 70% because there's no excess cash for land banking or anything like that. And on the developer balance sheets, they're just absolutely in survival mode, trying to repay debt, sell assets, etc. So the state of the market right now is pretty dire. But it could certainly get considerably worse.
And also it's worth noting that, you know, even though these start levels are still, as Dave said, some of the worst percentage change falls on record, we're actually falling from quite high levels because of the amount of stimulus that's been put. So if you looked at this relative to, say, the 2000s, in which they were building sort of a similar number, or they're trying to move a similar number of people, say, into cities, you could still fall 30-40% to get to those levels. So
absolutely. They're still massively overbuilding at these levels.
Yeah.
But what this is about is how quickly they do it. So, I would expect over the next decade that the floor area around construction will fall another 30% from here. And so it'll probably be down by half by the time we're done by, say, 2030 or 2035. Just given the decreasing number of people that they can urbanize because they're well past the peak. So, but, how quickly do they do it? And, and how do they manage the fallout for this sector in particular, the property developers. But I mean, for now at least, these numbers are far worse than any research that I've read on that's forecasting Chinese growth for next year. Most people have sort of 5%, 10% max falls in starts over the next 12 months from 2021 to 2022. And the difference for, you know, some of the commodities markets is huge. If it turns out that, you know, we get much more serious downside. At the moment, it is embedded. I think for the next 6 months, that it will be considerably lower. But, you know, there are lots of stimulus moves to try and turn it around. So let's have a look at what they've been and perhaps why they've done, haven't achieved much so far, but why they might and where they could go next. I've just put up a list here from Goldman on the number of incremental moves they've already done to try and save this. It's everything from microeconomic to macroeconomic. But the most important point to make is this is all incremental stuff, little bits at a time, which has completely failed to turn it around. It may have stopped it from plunging further, but I think probably the most important point to make about this is that they're not panicking yet. You know, a couple of times, you know, the authorities have gotten more aggressive where they've ramped up fiscal stimulus in the shape of infrastructure, and the PBOC has stepped in with some extra, you know, RRR cuts and even prime loan rate cuts now, which are basically cash rate cuts in effect. But they're still relatively small. They're not really adding that much credit generally, and they're certainly not adding a great deal to property. Like, they are still focused around property, more on SMEs, green development, infrastructure, etc. But of course, when China cuts almost invariably some money, in fact, it used to be a lot of money, trickles into property, whether they like it or not. But at this stage, with the three red lines still in place, it's not really about the price of money that's the problem here. It's credit availability is just not there for the developers. You know,
and as Dave was, you know, we had that chart up there. We didn't show the percentage rates, but, you know, for some of these developers, for a lot of those developers, certainly for any US dollar debt is, you know, 15-20% is the sort of rates they're paying. So yeah, whether the Chinese government cuts the rates by 0.5% or 1% or 10 basis points, like 0.1%, like they did recently,
yeah,
it's really not really making the difference. It's just whether people will lend to them at all.
No, that's right. But, exactly.
Yeah. In a way, what they're really trying to do, or what they're trying, you know, if they cut the home loan rates dramatically, what they're effectively trying to do at that stage is actually just take the pain away from the developers and put it on the individuals. That stage.
Yes, that's right. And they're loath to do that. And again, that, you know, China's been very loath to cut rates since 2015, since it had its capital outflow scare. And so it still is. And so it's still being very cautious on how it treats this shakeout. Now, it acts more aggressively whenever the developer credit crunch moves from high yield debt into more investment grade debt, like, so the supposedly quality developers, which are, you know, supposed to be able to survive this. For instance, over the last couple of weeks, we saw China's largest developer, Country Garden, which has survived this shakeout relatively well to date. Suddenly saw all of its bond spreads just explode. And it was getting sucked into this crisis. And then we've seen the PBOC get more aggressive. So they're kind of managing this line around where to let, you know, the ultra leveraged developers go bust without taking down, you know, the slightly less ultra leveraged to go bust. And for the time being, that is what they're doing. They're still managing that process. They haven't bailed it out. They haven't adjusted the three red lines. The latest move last night smells a little bit more desperate. Or yesterday, there's, you know, a plan afoot to allow the developers to get better access to the deposits that the market that homeowners or investors buy the property from them, and this is the funds that go into an escrow account. A lot of that had been frozen over the last kind of 6 months by local governments because of doubts about project delivery. There's moves afoot to try and loosen that up to give the developers access to that cash. But I mean, is that really going to reassure any potential buyer, you know, to give them all this money when they know it might go straight back out to a creditor somewhere? And again, it's more robbing Peter to pay Paul. There's a lot of hoo-ha about it in the press, and we saw some jumps in prices and things, but it doesn't look like a well thought through measure either. But again, it's incremental, and they're again trying to sustain the shakeout without letting it turn into contagion and get out of control. So where does it go from here? The consensus is that China needs to fix this. That's wrong, I think. Look, it may be right, but if it is right, it's right for the wrong reason. By that I mean, the only reason China would have to fix this is if it can't be fixed, if you'll pardon the paradox. Like, that is, if they can't manage through it and without it absolutely falling apart, then they'll have to go all in.
Yeah, and putting it another way, Dave, I guess what we're saying is, they know they need to deflate the property sector. They've got a golden chance, and possibly the last golden chance to do it. And there's a goods boom right around the world, lots of external demand. So that's sort of helping to sort of smooth the path. And what Dave's saying is, okay, maybe if that property sector starts to implode and is going to drag down the rest of the economy with it, then they'll have to get in and bail the thing out. But yes, that's just going to kick the can further and create a bigger problem somewhere down the line. But so they don't want to do that, but quite possibly at some stage they'll just have to. And I guess our contention is it's going to take a while to get there. And that,
well, I guess the thing is, for them to be forced to do that, it'll need to be a bigger crisis than it is right now. And so that in investment terms, that tells you it's got to get worse before it gets better. This consensus is that they need to stabilize things for this year so that Xi can, you know, get to his big meeting and get his lifetime endorsement as you know, the new emperor of China. I don't really agree with this. I don't see the point in putting forth all of these policies under the rubric of common prosperity as you're going into that process if you're not prepared to stand by it. It's very popular, common prosperity, this notion of common prosperity. And so a few billionaires and property have to burn, so be it. It will become much more of a problem if prices continue to fall, but in the property market itself. But at the moment, you know, in the top tier cities, that's not happening. The second tier cities, a bit more. And then the lower tiers, yes, where all the buildings been. But I think the jury's still out on whether this thing has to be stabilised in political terms.
Yeah. So I guess where you're getting to is, ideally, that the ideal situation is property prices might not crash. They might go sideways or a little bit down or whatever. But the actual development, the actual building of all this extra property, that's the bit that needs to crash.
Absolutely. Right. Yes. So the question is, can it crash? And they sustain enough growth to be credible. At this point, they look determined enough to still persist with it. Stimulus is getting more aggressive as the problem gets bigger, but they're kind of offsetting one another rather than the PBOC getting ahead of the curve or the fiscal stimulus getting ahead of the curve. That said, something that, you know, does give sort of cast doubt on how far they can push this is they haven't really put in a suite of wider rebalancing policies. Property taxes at this point, which would substitute for land sales that go to local governments and help fund them in the absence of this development, this property development model, haven't really been deployed widely or implemented.
They've been trialing them.
They've been trialing them, but for years, and it still looks like it'll be years more. Obviously, they're concerned about spooking investors and a run on the market, etc.
And part of the problem is, if there's so many of these properties that are that are empty.
Yeah, and even not, put a tax on them.
Yeah, not just the ones that haven't been sold yet, but the ones where investors have just genuinely bought these things and are just leaving them empty because they don't have the same savings mechanisms and the same opportunities. And so
you'd be putting a negative carry on them.
Exactly. Suddenly had to tax that, then they're going to want to either lease them out to people. And so all of a sudden, you know, soak up extra demand, or they're gonna sell them, and they could prompt a crash.
Yeah, so I mean, that's obviously they're being cautious on that, and even more broadly than that, there's just not a lot of rebalancing stuff about shifting income from the SOEs into households, which beyond the bashing of a few billionaires and forcing donations from high profile companies and stuff, and so that suggests. You know, there's something a bit idiosyncratic about the property reform project that, you know, means it might reverse, I guess is what I'm hinting at.
And given there's sort of 90%-ish of Chinese people own their own house already, then it's a big – when we're talking about prices, you know, if house prices fell by 30%,
I think without doubt they'd be – piling in long before that ever happened.
If it came
to that, the dynamics would be no different to Scott Morrison and Australia. It'd be kitchen sink time. So certainly if prices get out of hand to the downside, then I would expect a big save. But at this stage, you know, it's more just those frontier prices and cities that have fallen so sharply. And you know, can you afford for that investor class to take a bit of a hit, you know, without really upsetting things, you know, because, you know, as I say, the common prosperity thing is relatively popular. So, you know, just letting some more of the speculative investors burn, that might be something you can get away with. So they could persist with the shakeout. As it gets worse, and they support the economy with infrastructure. They keep cutting rates because there's no availability of credit to the segment. The price has to keep falling, and they're looking to offset that, you know, in the wider economy as well. Maybe if things get really ugly, there's a bad bank of some sort. We're already sort of seeing proto moves on that front with. You know, publicly owned developers buying the shitty assets of the private, and that could develop into something more formal.
And that's probably the real save. I think once you see real solid signs of like a large bad bank, effectively, and what we mean by that. So that was, I think that's was it 2000s? They had a similar one, or was it 90s?
Yeah, 90s, late 90s.
Late 90s they had, but similar crash. And effectively, what they did was bundle all the bad debts into a bad bank. And then, so you get the good banks. You got 10 banks that are good. You get 10% of their, each of them have 10% dodgy loans. You take those 10%, you put them all into a what's called a bad bank. The government then backs that bank. The other 9 banks can then go about their ordinary business. And this other bank sort of sits there and gradually works off its capital over years.
Yes.
And that's effectively what they did until that bad bank actually then started making loans and.
Yes,
and it had its own problems. Turned
into a bad bank itself. Yes,
yeah, that's right. An even worse bank. Yes,
yeah, Warung. So, I mean, that's not so much a save. That would end the crisis, but it's not going to prevent it.
No,
either. That's right. So that's actually would be a pretty sensible thing for them to do. So we're not sure, like. Do we go that route or do we end up with just the kitchen sink stimulus? At this point, it's difficult to say, but there are a couple of obvious triggers that would tip it one way or the other. The first one is if some of this developer stress suddenly filtered up into a major bank. You know, at that point, you know, we might go one way or the other at that point. Either end up with some kind of formal structure that starts to take these bad debts on, which would allow the adjustment to continue at a manageable pace, or, you know, PBOC just goes all in and the three red lines are removed and it's on like Donkey Kong for another 2 years. Another possibility is that the shakeout, possibly via falling prices, but certainly via falling starts, just gets too much for the fiscal stimulus offset, and growth just gets too weak. That's another possible trigger. I don't think we're confronting that this year, but it could get touch and go. And the other one is what we mentioned earlier, which is the impossible trinity, which is this notion that any country can only manage one of three macro levers at any given time, which is capital flows, its interest rate, and the value of its currency. And so if the PBOC keeps cutting, which I think it will, in the context of the Fed tightening, and you start to see, you know, capital flowing out,
and it controls its currency as well. Yeah. So of the three, it's the capitals. It's the one it lets come in and out.
Yes.
Whereas most other countries, it's the currency that is the one that flows.
So the yuan would fall. And I think it'd be quite happy for it to fall a little ways. But as we saw in 2015, that very quickly becomes a problem for the global economy insofar as emerging markets become uninvestable when the yuan is falling, because especially when the US dollar is rising, because US dollar debt gets more expensive for emerging markets, just as the Chinese economy gets more and more competitive for emerging markets. And so it takes this simultaneous capital and current account shock in emerging markets, which is to some extent narrative driven. These things don't happen overnight, but markets move on them anyway. And so that would be a really interesting global crisis development if we got that far. And that's a possibility where they would throw the kitchen sink at the property market at that point, take off the three red lines and as a way of avoiding cutting rates more, and, you know, possibly even throw some more fiscal stimulus at property prices, especially at the local level. So there are definite scenarios there where we get the kitchen sink this year, and there are ones where we don't, and it's not easy to determine which is which. Or the likelihood of each. Just hang on a sec.
I think Sam, I think we've got a few questions on banks.
Yeah,
that might be worth moving to.
Yeah. So you guys have answered quite a few of the questions as you've been discussing, but viewer question here. So it says there's 192 Chinese commercial banks. If they're connected to the property developers, and there is sort of a domino effect or a collapse. Is that gonna, flow onto Australia, or is it sort of too big to fail scenario, and they'll sort of contain it over there?
Well, I guess that's what we're talking about, is would they go bad bank or be forced to just pump up the assets again? And it's not certain at this stage, but I mean, if it will affect Australia either way. I mean, if we see the kitchen sink stimulus, we'd see all of the industrial metals rise, and especially iron ore, even from its current levels, it would probably go up. You know, I don't think it had threatened last year's levels, but, you know, we might get back up to 160, 170. And you'd have an extended commodity bid, which would probably actually threaten Australian real estate in a funny way, because, you know, the longer that bid goes, or the stronger it was, the more the Fed's going to be forced to tighten, and global interest rates will rise, and they'll force up the cost of funding for Australian banks. Assuming that, you know, the current sort of tightish state of Australian labour market would persist, then you would see some rate hikes in Australia, and I don't think it would take many to actually topple the property market, given the huge fixed rate stuff we've already been through. So, yes, this has immense implications for Australia, which way this ends up going in China. If it goes the other way, the bad bank scenario, I would expect the adjustment to sort of persist at a semi-manageable pace, in which case we'll see a terms of trade shock, because I think iron ore would just keep falling in that scenario. And that's not going to, I don't think, jeopardize Australian property. In fact, it might even give it another leg up. But it would come with a huge kind of income shock to the country that would take years to work off, and you'd have a new round of weak wages and, you know, the same sort of stuff that we saw after 2012, 2013, out to, you know, through the last cycle. It'd be a kind of return to secular stagnation. So depending on which way China goes, it's going to have very big impact, yes, over the cycle on Australia. I guess just to put some texture on that in terms of the actual iron ore market, for instance. So,
before we get to iron ore, just there's a couple other banking ones or crypto.
There's a couple of questions here. So, as you guys have been saying, you know, a lot of the Chinese have been speculating in the property. And if there is sort of a loss of confidence in that Chinese property market, do you think that money will move overseas? So that's one of the questions. And another one sort of similar, if the sort of yuan, the crypto and property are not safe for Chinese households, do you think that'll put a rocket under gold?
Okay, so I certainly think if you have the capacity to get your money out of China, then people will. In that scenario, yes, if the Chinese property market were to go belly up, but they have a fairly tight capital account, makes it pretty difficult for anyone who doesn't have a fair amount of money to get that money out. So I wouldn't expect it to land on global assets the way it did in, say, 2014-15, where Chinese money just flooded the Australian property market, flooded US property, UK property, and all sorts of other global assets, and under the endorsement of the CCP in some cases, and they all went nuts with it. And, of course, this is a completely different geopolitical environment now, where that kind of thing would be greeted with great hostility throughout a lot of the West. I don't think that a lot of the Chinese could get their money out. That said, when I say I think the yuan will fall owing to capital flight, I think the very wealthy will be able to do it. So it'll be certainly be enough for the currency to sink, and where that money would end up is a really interesting question. A lot of it, you know, it comes back to this kind of jousting between commodity prices that are being supported by Chinese stimulus and the tightening Fed is going to try and squash that. So where would that money go? I mean, it can't really go into US bonds. It might go into stocks. That said, I mean, if the Fed, I expect the Fed will eventually win this battle. So it might go into US treasuries, could go anywhere. Crypto, maybe gold. Gold, certainly, if you know, it depends on the wider circumstances and where we are in this process in the cycle. Like if we reach the point where the Fed starts to win this battle and global yields start to fall, then gold and crypto, yes.
Well, the question, though, between those two, Dave, is in my mind is going, okay, well, if within China they're saying property, yeah, people are worried about property, people are worried about the stock market, people are worried about household savings and all that type of stuff, does that mean you could see a flow in China at least into gold? I say yes. The crypto issue, possibly, but you know, China's quite anti-crypto, trying to put controls on that. But the other thing is to keep in mind with the whole crypto part is as well is, and the idea behind Tether is that Tether quite possibly has some very large debts. A lot of its money, a lot of the money which is sort of meant to be kept, in reserve, is quite possibly invested in a lot of Chinese developers. And so there's quite potential that there's money to be lost in that, which, so, you know, as long as the whole thing doesn't blow up and bring the whole edifice crashing down, then maybe there's a bid for crypto, but there's actually a there's a bit of a binary outcome, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that crypto is just acting as a kind of counter trend asset to, the US cash rate. So, depending on if you think that the Fed isn't done, then I wouldn't expect Chinese money flooding out to go into crypto. But if you thought the Fed was close to being done and is about to break things, then Chinese money may well flow into crypto.
Anyway, iron ore.
So iron ore property is, something like 40% of demand for Chinese steel. So it's obviously extremely material. That means every 10% move up or down is roughly about 60 million tons of iron ore. Clearly this is going to determine what's going to happen in iron ore this year. There's one other big factor to this, which we haven't covered much in this prezzo, but it's basically, the case that the land sales that I'm talking about that have crashed represent roughly a third of funding for local governments, and they in turn are a huge component of infrastructure spending in China. And so there is a pro-cyclical element to the falling or the developer crunch for broader construction. And if you put those two together, it's like nearly like infrastructure and properties, like nearly 70% of steel demand. So it's just everything. Now, at this point, the Chinese are well aware of this, and they're trying to, trying various policy measures to get the local governments being able to borrow despite these crashed land prices. It's early days. They didn't really succeed very well last year. They kind of did eventually. But what's coming out of China is suggesting they're not really going to go crazy with infrastructure bonds for local governments this year, roughly the same kind of quotas, but they'll try and fund more of it centrally. My kind of guesstimate for this is that we end up with roughly the same amount of infrastructure this year as last year. So I'm actually not expecting a great offset for the property downturn. I just don't think infrastructure will make it worse at this stage. They're probably going to get enough done to prevent it being worse. It might be a little bit negative, but as long as they're going to run a very deep deficit, federal deficit, then they might be able to fund enough infrastructure to get it done.
Well, and it's an interesting question as well as to what type of infrastructure they want to do at this stage as well. So infrastructure itself generally isn't that steel intensive. Some of the infrastructure that is, say airports, is quite steel or buildings, they're very steel intensive. Bridges are very steel intensive. But, if you're building roads and even railways, it's actually not that steel intensive to do.
It's not. I mean, I looked at the NDRC came out this week. That's the National Development and Reform Commission. They're the ones that approved the big infrastructure projects. Mm. And they've just pushed through like a swag of 100 new projects. And there is a reasonable amount of that steel intensive stuff, airports and bridges and stuff. But there's an awful lot of roads. And there is also, a green push in those projects. Increasingly they're of a social nature as well, social infrastructure stuff. It's probably over time, diminishing in steel intensity for the infrastructure pushes. Basically, if you take a base case of saying property starts over the 12 months fall 10% and infrastructure is stable, then assuming that the iron ore responds to any these kind of fundamental inputs at a certain point, it's going to fall because, you're going to need 60 million tons less iron ore this year than last, and then you've got almost that again coming on the supply side. So it's a decent amount of surplus iron ore that you'll have in the market. For the time being, things are going up on the excitement of stimulus and, so the seasonal strengths of rains in Brazil and restocking before Chinese New Year and, in this case, Winter Olympics, etc. But all that's pretty normal. And it's gone probably a bit further than you might have thought, but that's fine, or it's just a volatile commodity. So I don't think iron ore is in for a great year, nor either of the two coals. I think they'll both continue to deflate. But we are beholden to this, you know, kind of crazy bid for commodities that's coming out of the US and this, you know, this stagflation notion that has seized the imagination of Wall Street, and they're pushing it very hard. So we're fighting against that. And so, you know, there is this battle between the Fed
Can I just clarify that one as well? Because so really it's an interesting, a diametrically opposed argument is on one side, you have investors in the US saying inflation's running ballistic. What do you got to do? You got to get money into commodities because that'll save you from inflation. So that's that sort of bid from America coming out, sort of pushing into commodities. And then on the other side, you've got inflation crashing in China and, you know, the property market imploding, as we're talking about. And the argument over there is, China's about to, you know, the Chinese government will have to start stimulating soon. And so therefore buy commodities because you're going to get in front of it. And you're basically saying, you know, on one case you're saying inflation's too high, so buy commodities. And the other one you're saying inflation's too low, so buy commodities.
Yeah, I know.
And so it's you've got different people buying it for different reasons out there.
And well, I guess at the end of the day, I think both of those bids are just driven by too much money. There's just too much money floating around at the moment chasing crazy assets. And my exhibit number one for that case would be the energy markets, where oil's got a little bit of tightness on the supply side, but it's all artificial and it's going to diminish over the next 6 to 12 months. But we'll put that one aside. That's, you know, oil's a pretty idiosyncratic market, but things like coal and gas, where there's just an overwhelming abundance of supply, and yet they're pulling out prices that last year you wouldn't have thought were even possible. And it happens, like, you get these wild bids for a few weeks and then they collapse, and the volatility is insane. So I really don't think that they're driven by any ESG argument, you know, this notion that the green movement is going to prevent anyone from developing stuff. China had a coal crunch in December and it instantly, like, dug up an extra, God knows, like, millions, hundreds of millions of tons to solve it within a month. Europe was short of gas, and because the US has an enormous gas cloud, it all just flowed over the pond. And so there's plenty of these commodities, but there's just more money chasing them at the moment, and so we're getting these crazy moves. So anyway.
There's a few more iron ore questions we had.
You may have sort of answered this a little bit. But so Jacob's asked, iron ore, he says, iron ore dipped briefly below $100 and has run back up again. With the decline in the property sector, why is the market not priced in a fall in iron ore? And do you have an estimate of when this may occur?
Well, as I said, I think the current move up is you know, we went from 240 to 87. So that was a pretty good move. And then you're obviously going to get a counter trend move on the back of that. So a bear market rally. It's the seasonally strongest period for iron ore through Christmas with restocking, and supply side constraints on weather and stuff in the Southern Hemisphere. And then you got Winter Olympics restocking as well this year. And then you've got
China. What David says by restocking is basically people trying to get all their orders in before the Winter Olympics.
Yes. Steel mills ordering extra so they've got a stockpile. And then you've got all this Chinese stimulus fighting against the downdraft in properties. I mean, that's plenty. That gives you sentiment, seasonality, internal market dynamics, all sorts of things to explain a pop from 87 to 130. It's not unusual for iron ore. When would it roll over? I'd expect it to roll sooner through the Olympics and stuff. And then again, kind of March, April, these are all the seasonally weak periods. And then again in July, and then again in September. But that is going to depend on the timing of the stimulus that's fighting against it, and which kind of one of these two paths China ends up taking. If they go kitchen sink, then that's not going to come. That's not going to happen. Yeah. But they're not there yet, and I'm not certain they're going to get there. at all.
Yeah, but really, if you're buying iron ore at the moment, you're either betting on
You're definitely betting on kitchen sink stimulus if you're buying here now.
Yeah, like, that's right.
No doubt.
And it might be that kitchen sink, but also it's relatively imminent kitchen sink stimulus because if China ends up doing the kitchen sink, but they wait another 6 or 12 months before doing it, then iron ore is going to suffer a lot in the meantime.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah.
And I guess I'd say that's the argument against the primary argument against going long now is that for them to go kitchen sink, things would have to get worse first. Mm. I think at the moment it is bad, but it's kind of contained. Mm. So.
Well, that sort of leads to another question about, there was one in there as well about coronavirus and Omicron, is that, I think?
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about the supply chain issues in the past. And so the question is, do you think China's COVID zero policy will prolong the supply chain issues and thus inflation in the US?
Yes, I do a little. I don't think it'll be terrible, but I could be wrong on that. Like, at a certain point, it might just overwhelm their attempt to keep it out. But I think the base case is that it does extend it somewhat. There's another dimension to this, which I probably should have put in, actually, as a potential kitchen sink trigger. And that is, if Omicron really got out of hand, then...
In China. Assuming it is out of hand. I'm treating it as out of hand in most other countries.
Yes. If it got out of hand in China, then that's definitely a possible another trigger for it to just abandon all reform and go kitchen sink again. So, that's an oversight by me. Omicron is important in that sense. I think the base case is they're pretty good at stomping on coronavirus because, you know, there's no exhaustion in the population in China because you're at the, you know, the point of a rifle and you just do as you're told. So they are pretty good at containing these things, but Omicron is a difficult enemy for them. So that's a fascinating question for sure.
And that's as Dave was saying, you know, does that turn into a, you know, and given the speed of Omicron, does it turn into a 3 or 6 month burst of stimulus just to carry them through this Omicron, and then we're right back to where we started?
I think that's how you would see it. Yeah. Hmm.
And yeah. so you can also see how
that's tipping into what we've been discussing about the sort of American bid into commodities, the fear that Omicron will cause, you know, further inflationary shocks from China. But I mean, having said that, at the moment, all the indicators are that China is about to spread deflation. Like, most of the shipping indexes have started to fall at a pretty good clip. I'm pretty sure they're putting less and less into the top of the pipe in terms of shipping. The Baltic Dry is way off, and you know the PPI has peaked and is coming off hard. All the crazed bid into the like stable energy complex is falling, and I think is going to crash this year, barring another geopolitical shock like Ukraine and Russia. Possible, probably not the base case, but certainly a risk case. But gas, thermal coal, coking coal should all come down a lot this year, and in Europe as well. So, I mean, China is currently on the verge of exporting a lot of deflation. And especially if the yuan starts to fall as well, then it's explicitly exporting deflation.
Okay, and we've got a question here for you, David. Do you maintain your estimate of US $50 for iron ore in 2022?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Certainly, I
put that in scenario terms. Yeah, I mean, we basically talked about two scenarios. One in which they manage through the adjustment in the property sector. That is the $50 scenario. Yes. The other kitchen sink one, I would be wrong. At this stage, I would probably put the odds on those two at 60-40.
Which way?
towards the managing through.
Yeah. Yeah, and the issue is Omicron's been increasing that so whereas I think last year we probably would have been 80-20 to those ones, but Omicron's increased that the odds that you get a kitchen sink.
Yes.
In China. Mm.
And perhaps the fact that no matter what they've tried so far hasn't worked.
Yes.
So yeah, we would have shifted slightly towards, well, a little bit towards the probability of the kitchen sink, yeah.
Okay, and yeah, if there's any final viewer questions before we get into the investment implications, just pop them in the chat box now and we'll get to them after the investment implications.
Okay, so to try and summarize all of that rambling kind of macroeconomic discussion, it's an eerily similar setup to 2008, 2015 and 2018. In my view, where you have a China that's busting and a Fed that's tightening, and so the China's moved to loosening. So the Australian dollar's at this crossroads of really titanic forces, where you have a mad bid for commodities, and you also have a Fed that is getting more aggressive by the week, and then China leading the cycle here is obviously playing into the commodity bid and is potentially therefore exaggerating how tight the Fed's going to have to get. So in this circumstance, especially given oil is the key battleground here, I still think that the US dollar will remain strong, and I still think that the yuan is going to fall as the Chinese turn towards stimulus, especially the PBOC. So that gives you more stress in emerging markets. And you can see that already there's lots of stress in emerging market junk debt. It hasn't filtered back to the center yet. Developed market spreads have been good, even in high yield, which is one reason why the stock market's managed to hold up, although a lot of that emerging market stress is kind of slowly making its way back to the center as the Fed gets more aggressive. So as I say, where most of the energy complex is deflating now, not oil, absolutely not, but the broader energy complex is. I think that the bulks will resume falls next. You know, this is my base case still. Whereas the Fed tightens.
What Dave's saying by the bulks is your iron ores.
Yes, iron ore and coals and stuff.
Yeah.
And clearly oils and some of the industrial metals that are red hot at the moment, like nickel and stuff, they're riding this baby to the end. So that leads me to the conclusion that we've got one more down leg in the Aussie dollar, basically as this whole thing comes to a head. That would kind of end when the Fed does enough damage to deflate inflation, and in particular oil. It has to do enough damage to demand to curtail the oil bid. So that's still the base case, but then there is this risk case that either one of those trigger points we discussed in this presentation or Omicron triggers China going the kitchen sink, and then you know, you really do have a blow-off cycle ahead for commodity prices, and you know, the Fed chasing it up until it all just goes bust, and in which case Australian property would probably end up in a correction. But that is a risk case still, I think. At this point, it's still a base case, the rest of it.
Excellent.
Okay.
I think it sums it all up.
Yeah. So we don't have any more questions as such, but one of the viewers said that he's going to be closely watching the kitchen sink index next year.
You need a little TM behind that.
Yeah. Now we've got our question of the week. So this is for viewers to have some discussion in the comments section over the coming days. So the question is, will China throw the kitchen sink?
Yeah.
Have you got any last thoughts, guys?
No, that's about every thought I have in my head at the moment.
Yep. All good, Sam. I'm going to leave it at that. Get back to the beach.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for watching, everyone. Feel free to post your thoughts and engage with us and some of the other viewers over the coming days. Really informative discussion, and I hope the viewers got lots out of it. That almost wraps us up for today. So, I just want to thank you for joining us today, Dave.
Yep, pleasure.
And thanks for your insights as always, Damien. I hope you enjoy the rest of your well-deserved holiday.
Thanks.
And, we do welcome your feedback on the show, especially in regards to suggestions for future topics. If you do have any ideas, please drop it into the YouTube comments below or send us an email at contact@nucleuswealth.com. Just a reminder, this is general advice and does not take into account your personal situation. If you do want to discuss your personal situation, please go to our website at www.nucleuswealth.com and book a call with myself or the team. Don't forget to like the video now. And finally, if you know of anyone that might get some value out of today's episode, we'd really appreciate it if you please share it with them. If you'd like to see more of our previous content and episodes, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. And to stay up to date with news from us, you can also follow us on all major social media. For myself, Damien, Dave, and the rest of the team at Nucleus Wealth, thanks for watching, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Bye for now.